Yes, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Bryant, and this is Now We're Talking. Gareth Moses is a man I've only had occasion to speak to in short, fleeting bursts, and there's good reason for this. Gareth is my show neighbor here at CITR, occupying the 7 to 8 p.m. time slot with his electronic music show, More Than Human, which he has been hosting, I believe, since 2012. Is that true?
Yeah.
Right. Gareth also works in the film industry, and I strongly suspect originally hails from the UK, but I've yet to confirm precisely from where. His label mate, Matthew Griffiths, who occasionally joins him for the show, his label mate at More Than Human Records is here as well. They're both in studio with me now. Welcome, guys. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us in.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
this is pretty
nice
cool because, as I say, we pass each other. We've had a couple conversations that have lasted more than 2 or 3 minutes, but typically you come in, I leave, and we exchange pleasantries. So you're kind of like a mythical figure to me.
Well, funnily enough, you're actually the best person of all the shows that I've had transitions with, because it's not the easiest thing to pull off.
Sure.
And you have to have a good relationship with the person
before
and after. And you've made it very easy over the last. How long have you been on?
Since June. And it's interesting that you say that, because I remember a month or two ago, I was thinking, you know what? I don't think I'm giving Gareth enough time. In my mind, my show goes till 7. Am I going too close to 7? And this reveals my sensitivity that I would even ask you that question.
Yeah. No, you're giving me enough time. I think everyone gets, the longer you do it, the quicker you're ready. When I first started, I'd be so panicked about going on air and I'd want 4 minutes playing stuff, and people are like, well, you can't have that. You can have
because you kind of want to be precise
seconds,
and cover everything, right? Yeah. I think part of it for me is I have a background in music and stand-up comedy and all these things, and you make enemies fast if you eat into other people's time. People do not like that with good reason.
There was only one button that you left you pressed, and I didn't even know it existed on, I think it was a show that I did.
The headphones button?
Yeah, but the one that's just, what is, I don't know what that one is, but anyway, I was like, I was broadcasting, but I couldn't hear myself, and it was
still here. And then
you came in, and we
collaborated.
I said, "Oh, it's not working," and it was all being broadcast.
Now we know better.
Yeah. Thanks for joining me, guys. I know that you had to come in early to do this. Gareth, let's just start by giving me some background on More Than Human Records. Is it true that the show has been since 2012?
Yes.
Okay, so you've done it here since 2012, but what's the background of the record label?
Oh, okay. Well, the record label grew out of, I mean, I suppose it very much ties into the radio show. Prior to More Than Human, the radio show, Matthew and I used to do a podcast called Free Movement to Music.
Oh, cool.
Which is still a great title. It should be used for something.
Sure.
But we would fake a radio show in the sense that we would record intros and outros, and then we would take that and put it together with all the music pieces and idents and create a podcast as now a lot of people do. And I feel like we were a little, perhaps slightly
ahead of the curve
on that.
Yeah. Very slightly ahead of the curve.
Just ever so slightly,
But it proved to be a lot of work. Matthew's a film editor. And as you said, I work in the film industry. So trying to get both of us together with that time, not involving excessive alcohol, was quite difficult. So then when I found out about CITR and, I knew about CITR, but actually plucked up the courage or whatever to go, okay, I think I'll go and do the training and get involved. And I started that, and that was 2012, and was just to talk about this week's electronic releases and my love of electronic music. And then out of that, as labels started contacting me, or I'd be in contact with them to get the music that was coming out, I wondered whether it was possible for me to do it, to try and start a label.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something intriguing about being in doing something that you know nothing about, even though you love what it is about, you really know nothing about. And in film, some of the sheen over the years gets totally worn away by repetition and knowing what all the constituent parts pretty much are. So there's some of the magic, even from watching films or stuff, you know, there's a different way of, the way you look at it is slightly different. Music, I never had that. And I realized that if you had a record label, the mystery of music creation would remain, but you would still be engaged with artists and put out product that you liked. So with very little knowledge, and I don't even have much more now that I've been doing it for 3-4 years.
A tiny bit more,
but there's still loads of it that I get.
But there's a curiosity, a thread that you pulled on. I relate to you about having multiple outlets. For me, actually starting this show last year, I played music for many years.
Right.
And last year I just felt like, man, this has become kind of like going through the motions. I need to pull on a different, as they say, thread to see what that feels like. I'm assuming that you guys met in the context of the film industry. You were film editor.
We did. Strangely, Gareth and I both arrived from London in the fall of 93.
Oh, okay.
Not knowing each other in England.
Days
at all.
Apart, I think.
Days apart, yep. Hmm. And in the spring of 94, 95... into 95, I would occasionally bump into him on set when we were both working as, you know, lowly PAs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Learning the ropes, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's the connection.
Interesting. Yeah. And are you first AD, Gareth? Is that what
you're doing? I'm a first assistant director.
Right.
Which is basically a role, I don't know, when it first came about, I mean, it's been around for decades, obviously, but it's a kind of, I always think of it as a sergeant major. You didn't go to war with another country, but you're not the general, I suppose.
Yeah.
But you know, well, it's a terrible war metaphor, but you know, you organize and schedule the
you're corralling things,
the shots and the scenes and what order to do things in, and then on the day you're part of making sure everyone knows exactly what's going on, reacting to changes, helping to make decisions and disperse information, and yeah, so you have to be very present and communicative and, you know, guiding what's going on behalf of the director and the DP, I suppose. And I also think that you always have to be wrong, be comfortable with being wrong.
Right.
And go, okay, guys, this is what we're going to do now. And then it's like, hold on, that's not going to work. Okay, guys, that's not what we're
going to
do.
My apologies.
We're going to go over here now. So, yeah. But, yeah, I've done it for many years and I'm quite good at it, and it's good. Yeah,
my limited understanding of film sets, having some exposure to them, is that the first AD is a very significant role, and it's all about massaging these relationships between, you know, the different members of the organizational hierarchy on set. It seems like an important role. What do you think, Matthew?
Oh, it's a very important role. Yeah, you are.
You're allowed to say that. Gareth can't say that. It would sound immodest, but you can tell the truth here.
Yeah, no, I think that's how the day happens, is the quality of the chutzpah from the first AD determines how everybody reacts.
It sets a tone. On,
yeah. Early on, I realized that one of the things that was appealing about the work, about the job as well, was that you allowed to get your nose into everybody's business, because it's all there's nothing that you can't go, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to just tell me how that effect works, or how long it's going to take, and why isn't that person here, and what are you doing right now, and you know that we're doing this next, and you know, and that was. It meant that you got to see everyone's role and try and make sure all those pieces fit together.
What have you learned about people from functioning in that role? Because it feels like a good opportunity to learn something about people generally and how they relate to each other, or I don't know what you might learn.
Well, I think if you were to do the kind of character sketch of all the roles on set, and you know, you kind of a egotistical director or a kind of geeky science props, you know, props guy or effects guy, you know, so you had all those. The AD would be a kind of shouter and a bit of a dick, you know. and occasionally I hear, you know, I don't know, other people talk from other countries about jobs they've just done, and they're like, yeah, the AD was a bit of a dick or whatever. And I'm certainly have that ability, but
it's certainly within you.
But it's certainly within me. But it's but keeping it light and keeping it reasonably funny, like a light vibe. I mean, to be fair though, I think that I've said this many times, but it's the director's party. So if they want it, some people like chaos, and no matter how you try to fight against that, that's just the creative environment they want to have. So you have to kind of go along with that. Other people are like, I need to know to the minute exactly, you know, exactly what everything is, you know, going to happen. So it depends. So it's very much their party. But within that, I think just what I've learned about people, to answer your question, is people work well when it's light and supportive and it's a happier kind of environment, rather than, hurry the fuck, you know, you've got to go, come on, oh my God. You know?
Yeah.
And there's times you have to do that just because the sun's setting and you just like everyone has to go. And you know.
I have my own experience with what you're saying in the context of theater, to a limited degree with film, music, and all those things. It's so true. It's like when you want to collaborate and create things, it's really important how people are feeling and how they're relating to one another. So anybody that has a role that influences that, it's beyond the technical. It's more it's more about human relationships.
Well, and people, I mean, the easiest you get, we you know, often start with storyboards. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you will look at a storyboard and go, wow, there's no cars, there's no masses of extras, there's no animals, there's no children. This seems really straightforward. It's two people talking over a desk or something. And then the people turn up and it's a very difficult shoot because of other, you know, people, right?
Yeah,
their personalities conflicting with other people's personalities.
Yeah.
And then other jobs that you go, oh my God, this looks really tricky. We're blowing up a city or whatever.
Yeah.
Very easy because everyone's nice, you know, or, mm-hmm. or good at their job or whatever.
You know. Have you guys had occasion to collaborate on the same project, you as a first AD and you as editor?
Very infrequently. Gareth has been behind the camera wearing the director's hat on several occasions. And we've only had one opportunity relating to the label, which was a video that Gaz directed for a track from our most recent PyCorn Audio LP release.
Cool.
And I cut that. I'm a film editor by trade, and I cut that video, and that was a lot of fun. Yeah,
cool.
It's good. We're quite good at working together and not killing each other.
Yeah, yeah. You both seem to be alive, from what I can tell. You're doing a great job.
Barely.
I don't want to belabor the film thing, because we're going to talk about More Than Human, mm-hmm. but one more question for you, Matthew, is did you ever cut film, or has it always been digital?
I cut film once.
that was enough for you?
No, I would have loved to have cut film more. Louis Line, the man to whom I owe my career, and we cut an animation job in 1994, and that was the dying days of cutting neg, really. Mm-hmm.
Literally cutting?
Yeah.
Like splicing and cutting?
Yeah, we cut that job on a Steenbeck, and that was a delight.
Mm.
And I rail against our digital
presence.
There's been a big move away from shooting film towards shooting digital. And that, you know, then maybe that's a conversation for another show. But I have a great affection for film and what happens when the camera rolls and people stand in front of a crazy long strip of celluloid whizzing through a camera. It's very different than what happens with a digital camera.
Really interesting documentary called Side by Side. You ever see that?
It really shows those
enthusiasts that are going to hold on tight to film stock.
I try not to be too overly romantic about film, but it definitely was sexier.
But how can it not be romantic when you fell in love with it? That's how you fell in love with movies, was film, right?
It was funny. It's funny on the film thing, because sometimes the preciousness of the film or the amount of film that you could have at your disposal to shoot meant things could be really worked out and choreographed. But it also meant that you could not get the shot or not got the take that you really wanted because of the resources at hand. Whereas digital, we tend to roll on rehearsals because why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you couldn't just go forever, and there's no like, listen, unless we go and buy more film right now, we shouldn't be still shooting this.
Of course, it's precisely the same thing with music, right? I mean, with music, you can so different recording music when everything can be tweaked and adjusted and record everything versus being accountable for the cost of the tape.
Yeah, Brian Eno talked about that, didn't he? The limitation, you know, just having a set of limitations which you don't have on laptop creation, you know, electronic music and stuff, because you can go forever, but it's better to say, okay, you've got, you know, five tracks and only these sounds you can play with, and you've got to make something out of it.
I suppose it depends on one's personality and what's going to work for them or drive them insane. If they have a personality where they just can do anything, they just get lost in that and never complete anything. Well, let's segue to music and talk about your show a little bit more. I mean, for me, I'm a guitar player and singer, and that's kind of my culture with music. And so for electronic music, it's more peripheral for me. Maybe just talk about what I assume would be your love of it and the origins of that and what led you to this place of doing the radio show and having the label, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I've like most people, love all kinds of music and had a very strong relationship with it from a very early age. In England, it was always a kind of matter of life and death about what you were passionate about in terms of music. And very early on, with Kraftwerk and Gary Newman and stuff like that, when I was a teenager, really appealed to me, and so that strain has always carried on, and it's intensified, you know, as things changed in the 80s with techno and house music, and it's always been part of my musical world. And
did that genre kind of play out in a, I'm wondering if it was parallel to your own experience of being a teenager and becoming a young adult? It feels to me like, as a lay person, that the 80s was a pretty important era for this, right?
Yes, and the late 70s, because I was too young for punk.
Right.
And but there was that kind of Sheffield-based, I mean, it wasn't really just Sheffield, but it seems to be a locus for that of electronic music in the late 70s and Mute Records and, you know, Cabaret Voltaire and Human League and stuff like that, that I was at the right age for, and just seemed so other that really, really appealed. And I've talked about this before, and I'm not sure whether it makes sense or not, but it seems to make sense to me. There's a physicality to most rock instrumentation. I understand how a drum works. I understand how a bass, you know, and that's the appeal, is that it has a real physical presence.
Yeah.
There's something about, we were at a concert last night in Seattle watching electronic music, and you know, it was wires and things being plugged in and tweaked, and yet the sounds had no visual relationship to what people were doing.
It, right.
You know, and the sound was very, you know, it's still an unknowable world to me, and that appeals because it's not, you know, rock music. Once you get it, it's a variation on a theme, and it's infinite, but it's still a variation on a theme of, you know, the drum beat coming in and the riff being played and the chorus coming in. And but electronic music seems to have a, you know, a different feel, and I don't know how it all works. So it still sounds alien and heavenly and different to me.
Right.
And that's constantly appealing. And we're in a golden age of electronic music at the moment, I think. No doubt. And there's just sounds and tempos and construction and structures of songs and pieces of music that come out, and they're just so innovative and new and experimental and expressing a kind of something, you know what I mean, that's different, so different from rock, you know, and from more traditional kind of form of yeah, it's great. I love it.
Matthew, I heard you say no doubt. Do you want to flesh that out?
I think that
he loves No Doubt.
He's obsessed. Yeah. He can't help but plug them.
The way that Gwen dresses.
He's like, just play something from Tragic Kingdom right now. Just throw to it right now.
Riffing on why it's a golden age. There has been a club culture, for better or for worse, has become very broad and has entered the mainstream in an interesting way. I think people are listening to what was traditionally only heard in the club in a much broader context. And club music has morphed, has changed shape as well to become a more expressive form of art. And that's why I think it's a bit of a golden age. There's so many opportunities to listen and so much wonderful experimentation going on, particularly by young producers.
And that's part of the digital revolution as well that we were talking about before, is access to equipment and sounds and processes and ways of creation that I think were limited before. You know, the joke was, well, not the joke, the, if you look at early electronic music, kind of post-Kraftwerk in Britain, a lot of it came about because cheap synthesizers were suddenly available in like home catalog, or like Argos or whatever, where you have to pay a pound, like the Sears, you pay a pound a week for 20 weeks. But prior to that, they were the playthings of rich rock gods, you know, huge Moogs and Mellotrons and all that kind of stuff. And suddenly they weren't.
Not accessible.
And it was easier, I think, you know, slightly reductively, but it was easier to get to grips with it than a guitar and just play out a riff on a keyboard.
Right.
And software allows that now.
And software
Ableton, again, for better or for worse, because of course the facility with the software comes with, you know, creates restrictions in itself. But the digital landscape has opened it up.
And it just means that you don't need an awful lot of money. If you have a creative spirit and this is the way you want to express yourself, you will be able to do that, and you will be able to do it in a really interesting way that, to me, I know comparisons are kind of odious, but if you get four guys together in the traditional garage band kind of way, they have to be really amazing songwriters to really break out of that. I'm not saying that electronic music then is you know, better because of that, but the way that the kind of strands of the creation and what's going on spread out are just, I don't know, it just feels like really rich, and if a creative person will be able to do something really, really interesting with the tools available without necessarily spending lots of money or, you know.
Yeah, I guess you could say that it's a golden age for just being creative generally.
Sure.
In terms of the creative process and using leveraging technology to create, but also dissemination, mm-hmm, both of those things. Like, yes. Here we are talking about podcasts.
And distribution.
It's like,
yeah,
it comes, yeah, down to creating a thing and sharing
getting
a thing.
It out. Yeah.
And it's just in our lives, it's like a radical, yeah, radical
hugely
shift.
Different.
And yeah, there's a lovely, another thing that appeals to me about it is that there's a certain, of course, it's not ego-less at all because any creation involves that, but it's, electronic music is just so rarely about the traditional representation of an artist in the kind of classic rock sense. Mm-hmm. And the personalities are just, so you get people who wouldn't have their voice in, yeah, in rock music will have their voice in electronic, mm-hmm, music, because it really doesn't matter about what you look like and
your
what
brand,
you represent.
Your clothes, exactly, and your name or whatever.
And you can create that kind of virtually, if you like, or as part of the identity of the electronic music,
right,
through, you know, art and identity and everything else. That,
right,
that's really exciting. I think that's a much, mm-hmm, more interesting way for that art to be disseminated,
yes,
rather than through traditional modes of representation.
And with that in mind, I'm curious who's on your label and how you source these people, and do you meet them in person or you find them on the internet? How does it, what's the process?
It's a good mixture of things. I'll tell the anecdotal
Please.
Story of how Gareth managed to chat up Dieter Moebius, who's a German musician, very famous in krautrock. I'm making air quotes there, krautrock circles. Dieter Moebius of Cluster and Harmonia. He came to town and played a little gig, and just through sheer force of will, liberally lubricated with whiskey from the bar at the Cobalt. Gaz just chatted him up, you know, strong-armed him, said, "You're not leaving," pretty much, until, not exactly that, until you agree to make me a record. All the while I was chatting up his wife at the bar, you know, trying
and
to...
And that actually says more about your role, yeah, in the company.
I run interference.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's all it's an elaborate process.
So that was how Dieter's record came about, and that was a lot of fun.
And he disagreed. He's like, "You strong-armed me, I'm going
to
do
well,
it."
Well, I think he just looked at, you know, Gaz was so forceful in his request that it was hard to say no to.
Right.
How else?
Well, I get this asked a lot because there's a traditional understanding. There's either no understanding of record labels, which, mm-hmm, is fine, mm-hmm, or some understanding comes from like a Richard Branson Virgin Records kind,
right,
of idea.
A historical thing, yeah.
Yeah. And we don't have the resources to do what that model of things, which is where you sign someone to your label and you provide them with money in order to,
right,
for them to experiment and record, and you know, we just can't do that. And even before what we were doing, that this model already existed in electronic music and experimental music, where it's a form of commissioning. So you as an artist would be putting out records on different labels. You're not, mm-hmm, signed to one. Obviously, the more successful you are, you tend to end up with one label, but at the level we're playing at, which is, you know, you can't sign them, right?
The strong arming doesn't involve you demanding exclusivity, which makes it easier.
Exactly. No, because yeah, I can't, because they would say, "So what's the deal?" And I go,
yeah,
there is no deal.
Yeah.
You know, there's, I can't pay you,
yeah,
you know. So what we can do is collaborate. Yeah. I can provide funds to manufacture this record. We can collaborate on art and a curational kind of aspect of what kind of music we're going to put out by you, because I really like your music, mm-hmm, and we can then distribute that, and if we make some money we can split it, being artists, that's appealing to them. So yeah, as you said, we spoke to Moebius that way. I've listened to music a lot for the show. That's where it ties in really nicely with the show. And sometimes you listen to the music and you're like, this person has done really great work. I'd like to be involved with that. I'd, mm-hmm, like to see whether they can put out other work. Sometimes you get to speak to them when they've really, Boreal Network, who is a fantastic artist, she hadn't put out she'd put out some tape releases and it was quite low key stuff. So this was the first final release and we've developed relationships. We're going to do some more work with her. Other people like Pie Corner Audio were somewhat established with other labels, and we kind of got in on that because we're like, we really like your work. And for Martin, who is Pie Corner Audio, that's a good way of just keeping product out there. You know, he's got a lot of work that he wants to share. So yeah, it kind of varies case by case.
Real miscellaneous ways we approach A&R. Yeah.
Yeah. When you're doing your show here at CITR, is it obviously you're going to feature your artists and also other things you're hearing, you're influenced by? What's the sort of ratio between those disparate options?
Oh, not very much of us. Okay. Because we put 3 or 4 releases out a year. You know, it's not like we're putting, I mean, because we put out physical, you know, we put out vinyl.
Really?
If we put out just digital releases, then you can put that out a lot. And a lot of companies do that. A lot of record labels do that. And when I started, that wasn't of interest to me, and it kind of still isn't. I like the physical product, and there's a certain kind of wonderfulness about pressing vinyl.
Of course.
So, yeah, the ratio in the show is we don't actually play that much of our own artists. We play a lot of our artists who may have done work for other labels because we really like their work.
When was the first time you printed vinyl? I find this interesting.
When we pressed the first record was The Passenger, who is Jesse Creed, who's a local artist in Vancouver, and that was 2013.
Yeah.
June.
What did it feel like to participate in creating a record and then hold that record? I mean, that must have been pretty cool growing up.
It was good. I mean, I over-imagined, I think, all our records are designed by a company in Sweden, in Stockholm. Apart from one that's just about to come out, actually. But so the design was very important, the kind of branding of them, not in a corporate way, but just because the labels that I grew up with that I really loved, like Factory, you know, or ZTT or something like that, ZZT, they have a look that's consistent across their releases. And that's something that really appeals.
Mm-hmm.
So we came up with this elaborate idea on the first few releases, and it involved a wraparound decal sticker that went on card sleeves that had recessed pieces to them, and so that had to be all pre-pressed. And it turned out to be a bit of a nightmare, because it was great as in terms of a piece of imaginative,
but logistically more involved.
Yeah, it was very tricky.
Worth every
we changed
every
it
opportunity.
Up. Yeah, it was good. It was a good way, and people noticed it. But we changed it up after, I think, 6 of those releases. We changed our house style.
Mm-hmm.
But no, to answer your question, it was extremely exciting, and it's very different from the film industry because it moves at a very different pace.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great talking to other label heads or A&R people or presses and finding out the process isn't the right way to do things and the wrong way to do things, and I've each release has taught me something different that you just go, oh, okay, that would be a good idea to do it this way now. And I mean, all our stuff is released digitally. After we release physically, you get a download code, or you know, you get a free download, and then after a few months we release it so that anyone can buy
it's nice to have the best of both options. Like, that's why I enjoyed doing the show here. It's a radio show, but it's also the podcast for the majority of people who consume it that way. So how many releases are you guys up to now?
12, just about to release our 12th.
Yeah.
That's pretty great.
The Robert Lowe record is number 12. And then the 13, 14 are in the works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the next one we're releasing is an album called To Orb Real by fantastically named artist Robert Akey Aubrey Lowe. Robert Lowe is a experimental artist. He plays in a band called Om, a drone rock, a more traditional rock band called Om, who played here recently. He's a keyboard and percussionist in that. But he also works with Johan Johansson, who's a soundtrack composer who's doing the new Blade Runner.
Oh, cool.
He did the Arrival, the science fiction film. So Robert was involved was involved with both of those records. So yeah, he's a very special artist.
Yeah, yeah, it's modular synthesizer music most of it, and it's going to be a great release.
It takes the form of a kind of I came up with this idea of faux tracks, like, which were soundtracks for films that don't exist, and they're like kind of library music. I don't know whether you know about library music records, but they're basically, you'd have a record library being a company that would say, okay, we're going to put out, before digital, they would put out records with 20 tracks on the record, all with different emotional kind of cues. So one would be for, you know, a dramatic moment,
okay, set you know,
and then film or documentaries would use those and pay the rights.
Right.
But the way you found out whether you wanted to, use it or not was by getting these records. So and library music's fantastic because a lot of these musicians would then do really interesting work that it didn't have to succeed commercially at that point of creation.
It was, so they weren't bound by
that. And it wasn't like to write a hit song or anything.
Right.
So you'd have very interesting people. Anyway, so the Robert Lowe album has is a kind of a themed album around the idea of African science fiction. And a lot of them take the form of these kind of library cues, some short, some very long. But yeah, it's super interesting work.
Yep.
You mentioned Blade Runner there earlier. I'm just thinking for myself and for, like, again, the layperson listening, what are some examples, for my own curiosity, of where this genre has crossed over into mainstream films? Like, I don't know if this is sacrilegious. I have no idea. But I think of the movie Drive. Do you have anything to say about that? Am I on the right track in terms of how this genre moves into mainstream
Drive's
film?
Drive's a slightly tricky one because Renfing approached, and I'm going to get the name wrong now, the Portland-based musician who releases records as Glass Candy and creates the music for the band Chromatics. And he created a soundtrack that was much more synth-driven than what Renfing ended up using for the film. And I believe that it was one of those projects where an amazing amount of great music was abandoned at the last minute in favor of the music that did come out, which really captured people's imaginations somehow. But, so maybe it was the correct decision, but it's a politically slightly fraught thing. It's a bit like Wendy Carlos and her music for A Clockwork Orange, which, you know, an enormous amount of work went into, and then Kubrick at the last minute said, no, doesn't work. I want this. You know, I want to keep it classical.
It's been mainstream from the beginning, because if you think that the first all-electronic score was for Forbidden Planet in 1956, that was an A-picture release, like a summer blockbuster. Was like Guardians of the Galaxy of its day, in the sense that it was big budget, massively successful, big, colorful science fiction film, and its score was completely electronic.
Wow, and 50s, wow.
Yeah, you've had theremin being used in work in the 40s.
That's true, in horror films.
In horror films and in, you know, even adventure and action films. So, yeah, I think it's, I don't think it's an outlier. Like, I think it's all been part of the mainstream. It's just whether it's contextually the right type of music to use for the film in question.
But sure. Yeah, Evangelis and Blade Runner is probably maybe the the ultimate for what that crazy Yamaha synthesizer,
what the
emotions he was
about
to evoke, you know, and that so many people. And I guess Chariots of Fire had a broader reach for people going out and buying.
And parallel to that, Tangerine Dream, very early use in 70s films of, you know, like very synth based sounds for the whole score. So
yeah, it's interesting to think about some of these instruments for me. The theremin, of course, now it later makes an appearance in popular music with the Beach Boys in the late 60s. And thinking about the Moog, and for me, I love the Moog used in indie rock in the early 90s, but I feel like the Moog, there's some of that in Abbey Road, like the late 60s. I don't know how long that had been used by other bands, but
it's,
for me.
And it's, I've always said Moog, and we're wrong. It's
what is
Moog.
It? Moog? M-O-O-G, Moog.
I know.
Very counterintuitive.
Very counterintuitive.
But we're committed.
I went to the Moog Festival last year in Northern Carolina, and it's Moog.
This is like this is how people tip off that they're not quite sophisticated enough.
Moog, well, I said it all my life. I was always like, Moog, listen to the Moog on that. Amazing.
Yeah. I think there's a... It has a much broader reach, to Gareth's point, than one might imagine. You know, one often thinks of electronic music as being niche, but it's a much more prevalent.
I think it's
form.
Also that if you take it out of its context, if you listen to the Forbidden Planet soundtrack just as a soundtrack, you're like, wow, this is deeply experimental, strange music. It's bleeps and bloops and not rhythmic and very odd. But within the film, no one went, what the hell am I listening to? They just went, well, it's a great film, and we're on an alien world.
Film.
Why would we not have this alien score? The classic example in England is all the work done by the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, which was a group of musicians hired by the BBC, you know, to set up this workshop to provide music for their shows. And the hugely successful one would be the theme to Doctor Who. But they did strange music for an awful lot of TV series, and now it's it sounds so kind of ahead of its time. And that's the stuff that, you know, when I was a little boy watching TV, that would seep in, and you know, and you would, you know, it's now so evocative if you hear certain tunes that are strangely experimental and electronic based, but they just have this huge nostalgic value.
Yeah, I remember the experience of being around people in film school or being around student films quite a few years ago. And I feel like a lot of people think, when they think of film, understandably, they think of it as a visual medium because they go and they stare at a screen, but they completely underappreciate sound generally. Mm-hmm. And of course, music and the tone that sets when it comes to sound, things like Foley and ADR and all of that does to like take you from watching something to being inside of something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's the power of sound generally, including
did you see
music.
12 Days in Is it 12 Days in September, that documentary that Kevin...
About the Munich crisis?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the end of that involves a very skillfully put together montage of the moment that the plane blows up, I think. Or
I haven't seen the film,
anyway,
so I can't.
People are dying, and it's intercut with reactions and different elements from the time in which this was happening. And it's very, not avant-garde, but it's not a narrative piece. It's like suddenly lots and lots of images, frantic montage. And it's set to... like a pop version of Ode to Joy by the amazing Apollo 100. And it's such a strange sensation because you get very emotional because if you followed this narrative and this is the big climax. And the music is completely cheesy, but it works fantastically well with the image. And it's two things that on their own would have some kind of effect.
Right.
A third effect is created, and a much bigger effect by putting
creators
in
the sum of all parts.
Completely.
That's a beautiful thing with art, is when ideas come together, or images, sounds,
and they contrast.
Colors.
Yeah.
Well, we're having a good conversation. I sense we could talk for much longer, but you guys have a show to do.
We do.
And as a good
already.
Show neighbor,
I'm
mindful of that. I'm looking at the time thinking, this is about the time I should let these guys do their show. So, Gareth, thanks for joining me. Gareth Moses,
thank you.
Along with Matthew Griffiths. They host More Than Human here on CITR. They have a record label called More Than Human Records. And within a matter of minutes, they'll be hosting that aforementioned show here on CITR.